Bom dia a todos do canal IMF Brasil. Meu nome é Daniela e eu estou aqui junto com a doutora Silvia Aroca, física da UFSCar, da Celular e Saúde, e nós vamos entrevistar hoje a doutora Erika Mallory Blythe em uma conversa como as radiações não ionizantes ou micro-ondas afetam o nosso sistema central e a matriz celular. A doutora Érica é fundadora de Médicos pela Sociedade da Saúde em Radiação e Meio Ambiente, The FIRE, e também. Ups!
Ô, Daniela, só posso te corrigir numa coisinha só?
Claro!
Então, eu me formei pela USP. Eu não sou da UFSCar, quem é da UFSCar é meu marido.
Ah, me desculpa, então.
Tudo bem.
E doutora Érica é membro honorário da Sociedade Britânica de Medicina Ecológica, consultora médica da Associação de Aconselhamento Científico sobre Radiofrequência da Oceania, consultora médica da pesquisa em segurança radioativa, eletrossensibilidade do Reino Unido e membro de diretrizes internacionais para radiação não ionizante. Então, doutora Érica, welcome to Brazil, Dr. Erica.
Thank
We're
you.
very honored to have you here.
Thank you so much. It's an honor to be here.
We're going to talk about electro hypersensitivity and what are the symptoms that people could recognizing themselves while they are using their wireless technology, such as laptops or mobile phones or any other that came to the market now, like the new devices that talk to people and you give them chores and they get everything connected in your house.
So some of the most common symptoms are things like headaches, sleep disturbance or insomnia, palpitations, tinnitus or a kind of ringing sound in the ears. But I have a slide on this. Would you like me to start the slide showing?
Yes, please.
Okay, so I'll just share my screen and I'll get the right one for you. Here we go. So can everybody see that now?
I don't see. Yes, I can see it now. We can all see now.
Okay, great. So this just is a brief introduction. I've put together slides to cover about 30 minutes, and then I gather we'll have some time after that for some questions. So feel free to write your questions down, gather them up as I'm talking, and then we'll address them all at the end. My background is emergency trauma medicine, and I worked in hospitals in the UK and abroad over about a decade in various aspects of emergency medicine. And then about 10 years ago, I got into radiation research. And it was very obvious to me that very few doctors are educated on the subject of non-ionizing radiation specifically. So once many people asked me to lecture a lot on this subject, and when I realized I was quite overwhelmed by that, I put together a group called FIRE, Physicians Health Initiative for Radiation and Environment. So you can find our website at firemedical.org. And these are some of the important things that we're trying to address. These are our mission statements at the moment. So I'll come back to this list at the end because I think it'll make more sense after I've talked a bit about electromagnetic hypersensitivity or EHS. So we have four main areas that as a group we are trying to facilitate information about. And we have a small leaflet available to give some facts about 5G, which is obviously a very current hot topic. We talk a lot about safe schools and giving low EMF environments to children at school, which I think is increasingly really important as tech's being used more and more for children in schools. And EHS medical awareness, I'm going to talk about in this lecture. So we'll say a lot more about that in a moment. And lastly, I have something called the SAFER Initiative, which stands for Safe Areas for Electromagnetic Refuge. this is something which is increasingly needed, is areas where either people with EHS or other vulnerable groups can be supported and have their health managed in a low EMF environment, which has become quite difficult to find now. So through the course of the next half an hour, very briefly, this is kind of we're just touching the surface in such a short time, but I'm going to introduce a few very basic concepts about electromagnetic radiation, which are really relevant to the discussion about EHS. We're going to characterize EHS a little. We're going to describe it, explain what we mean by this term, and then talk about some very basic management concepts in terms of how to protect and support people with this health issue. And then lastly, a bit about moving forward, the future and mitigating this issue. So very briefly, the electromagnetic spectrum is divided into a couple of different areas. There's the non-ionizing portion, which you'll see on the left here, which is our communication frequencies. And at the bottom of that, the very low frequencies that we have in our household wiring and overhead power lines. Both of those types of frequencies I'm going to be talking about in this particular discussion. The higher frequencies.
Dr. Erica?
Sure,
I just wanted to say to you that you have to move your slides, okay, on your computer. It's not automatic.
I've moved them. I'm on the fourth slide. So I've been moving them as I've been talking. Have they not moved for you?
No.
Ah.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
I tell you what, I'll stop sharing the screen for a minute and I'll restart sharing it. What slide do you have in front of you?
The first one.
Ah, okay. So it's not been changing them. I will stop the screen sharing and we'll restart it and see if it works this time.
Okay.
Okay, so can you see the change in screen now?
Yes, it has changed. It's the three of us now.
Okay, so I'll go back and reshare it and we'll see if it updates. Right, so here I'm sharing again. Can you see a new slide?
Yes.
And yes. I'll restart the presentation and I'll quickly show the other slides so that hopefully you'll get those. So I'm going to change the slide. I'm going backwards now. Tell me if that worked for you guys.
It didn't change, no. We have the electromagnetic spectrum.
Okay, so it seems the screen sharing in your software isn't working, but in that case I would suggest that I'll just talk through the slides, and if there are important slides that I really think you need to see, then I will do what I just did. And you've probably got one up in front of you now saying it with a picture of the electromagnetic spectrum, is that right?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to make this screen a bit smaller. And I'm going to stop sharing my screen and I'll just leave myself on the screen because there's no point in you staring at that. And then what we'll do is if there's a very important slide, I'll do what I just did and then you'll be able to see that one. Does that sound like a good option?
Yes, it's a good idea, yes.
Okay. So can you see me again now on the screen with you guys?
Yes.
Yep.
Yes.
Okay. So I'll be looking at them, but and I'll tell you if there's an important one. So I was just talking about the different frequencies and you got to see that spectrum chart that was basically showing you how the lower frequencies are the ones that are in your household wiring. Now, those also can affect people with EHS. The high frequencies, the ionizing portion, that part is already known to damage health. That can cause ionizing of molecules, which we know causes damage. And for many years, people thought that the lower frequencies didn't cause any health damage. But we now know through many thousands of papers that actually those lower frequencies can damage even below what we call thermal thresholds. So A lot of different devices emit this, the communication proportion of the spectrum, things like your mobile phones, your Wi-Fi routers, computers, baby monitors, and a kind of ever-growing list of items. New items come on the market every day. And I'm going to tell you some fast facts that a lot of people don't necessarily appreciate about radio frequency radiation, but that I think will help you understand the context of this lecture a bit better. Radio frequency can damage biology at very low intensities, much lower than we were previously led to believe, and unfortunately lower than many of the different international safety standards. So here in the UK, the safety standards we use are something called the ICNIRP guidelines, and they were designed to protect against tissue heating. So basically your microwave oven has radio frequency radiation at a level which increases temperature. That's how it cooks. Now your cell phone actually uses the same frequencies, but just at a much lower intensity. And in the past, we thought that those low intensity fields were safe, but we now realize that actually even very low intensities can affect cellular function and in some cases structure. And what's really makes this even more difficult, both experimentally and in terms of trying to predict health outcomes, is the fact that biological disruption is not linearly proportional to either the frequency or the intensity of the radiation exposure. We have windows where actually a lower frequency or a lower intensity of radiation can in some cases been shown to have a greater biological disruptive effect. So with that in mind, I'm going to move on to say a few words about electromagnetic hypersensitivity. Now, I defined this condition back in 2014 as a multi-systemic condition characterized by increased sensitivity to electromagnetic fields of increasingly broader frequency ranges at lower and lower intensities. So what I mean by that on a practical level is, imagine a lot of you will be familiar with this. A lot of people complain of a bit of discomfort or warmth or increased sensitivity around the ear when they're using a phone. For some people, that progresses to a real headache. And so instinctively, they move the phone away from their head while they're talking. But they may continue to get those headaches and find that actually they get to the point where a phone even being held in the next room or quite a long way away can actually give them the same headache. So that's why what I mean by increasingly lower intensities. Now, in terms of increasingly broader frequency ranges, if that is left unmanaged, if people continue to have these exposures, they might find they start to get those same symptoms in response to the Wi-Fi from their computer or a base station outside with mobile phone radiation, or even from their household wiring from the very low frequency fields. So the amount of different frequencies they respond to can broaden. And in terms of the kinds of symptoms, I've already mentioned headache, but like I said earlier, tinnitus, dizziness, palpitations, these are all very common symptoms, and insomnia or sleep disturbance is also very common. Another thing we see is that electromagnetic sensitivity tends to go hand in hand with chemical sensitivity. So for quite a lot of people, as they become more electrically sensitive, they also develop a sensitivity to chemicals, particularly hostile or toxic chemicals and volatile agents. So, but one thing I wouldn't want you to think is that this is a very unusual condition that only affects a really minute proportion of the population. I don't think that's the case. I think this is a kind of grey spectrum where we know that on a cellular level, everybody is electromagnetically sensitive. That's how your cells communicate. It's how they receive cues from the environment. So biologically, you are electromagnetically hypersensitive. But the point at which that translates into conscious symptoms is at a different level for different individuals. So some people will be far more sensitive than others. But I think for very mild symptoms, you know, mild headaches or occasional palpitations or mild sleep disturbance in response to electromagnetic fields, this is actually probably very common, probably far more common than we previously thought. But most doctors are not trained to recognize it, so they don't think to offer this as a therapy for people. The minute anyone presents to a general practitioner with, you know, headaches and sleep disturbance, I would say the very first thing their GP should say is, you know, try lowering some of the electromagnetic fields. And in some cases, those symptoms might disappear. but we need to increase medical awareness so that doctors know to give that advice. Now, there is a slide here that might be useful for you guys to see. So I'm just going to try and share this one. Let me go back to screen sharing for a moment. So share. Unfortunately, there's a lot of different buttons to press before I can share it for you. So forgive the delay. Can you see that now? Can you see that? Oh, I think you guys are muted, so I can't hear you.
Yes, you can see that. We're muted. Okay. I'm sorry.
No worries. So this is a graph of a paper that was published some years ago now by Santini et al. This just shows that for some people, the closer they live to a mobile phone base station, the more they were likely to have these symptoms: headaches, irritability, fatigue, sleep disturbance, skin problems, which is another one I hadn't mentioned yet, but rashes and things are quite common. Visual and hearing disruption, again, quite common. And these might sound like quite vague symptoms, which they are in some ways. These can be caused by a lot of other things. But when you put the constellation of them together, this is quite a reproducible constellation of primarily neurological symptoms that we see repeated in the literature over and over again. Now, in terms of how many people are likely to have this issue, people ask me this quite a lot, and it's a difficult one because it depends on how you're classifying it, whether we're talking about just the mild cases, in which case I think it's a very large number of people, or the severe cases. So very severe cases that stops people working and living as normal is probably less than 1%. But for milder cases, maybe well above 10%. And we may be looking up to 50 for the real mild cases in the population, in which case this is a very serious health issue. It's higher than the number of people, for example, who use wheelchairs. And when we look at how we've adapted and changed society to accommodate people who need to use wheelchairs, we need to be doing the same thing to allow access to public spaces for people with EHS. Now, I'm guessing I'm back on your screen. Is that right? Yep. I'm getting a nod, so I'll continue. I'm going to keep moving through the slides, but if I see ones that I think you guys might appreciate looking at, I'll pick them up again. Moving on, there tend to be three phases to EHS. There may be predispositions, so certain genetic factors or epigenetic factors may make some people more vulnerable. Dose, obviously, is important. People tend to have a triggering event. Now, this might be a relatively low dose of EMF, but consistently for a very long time period. Or it might be an increased sudden EMF exposure that's very high intensity. And there have been some papers published on base station workers, for example, where a mask worker has been working on the mask. It was thought to be off and later found to be switched on. And they've developed electrical sensitivity as a result of that very high exposure. But what's very interesting is a number of other bodily assaults, if you like, can set up this increased sensitivity, including toxic chemical exposures. I liken this a bit to pregnancy state in that it seems to be a defensive position, and it kind of makes sense physiologically for the body to upregulate its sensory system when it feels threatened. So there can be a number of triggers, but in order to call this EHS, then the maintenance or the ongoing symptoms must be caused by electromagnetic fields. Otherwise, we're looking at a different diagnosis. So if somebody's getting these symptoms, but in response to chemicals, for example, we would call that MCS or multiple chemical sensitivity. But as I mentioned, we often see the two come together. Okay, now this is kind of an important slide. So I'm going to go back and screen share this one for you as well. Okay, here we go. So you should have a slide now which says staging. Now, this is to explain that I have devised a staging criteria that I think will be useful for medical doctors. I've got a circle around stage one here because this is where we want to pick people up. I've mentioned these mild symptoms. Now, if we were picking people up in this stage and saying, try lowering your exposure, they would never progress to stage 2 and 3. And this is the point at which they're very reversible. They can potentially live a very normal life by just changing a few things to lower their exposure early on. Once people have more, and at this stage, by the way, most people don't know what's causing their symptoms. They might just say to their GP, oh, I've got some headaches, or I've got a bit of hearing disturbance, or some mild palpitations that are a bit annoying, but nothing severe. And unfortunately, the GP probably won't recognize what the cause of that is. But once people move to stage 2 and 3, where they have moderate or severe life or disabling symptoms, they are not reversible. So what I mean by that is that they need to be in a long-term low EMF environment at that point. And this is very disruptive. It means people often can't stay in the same home. They can't go back to their normal job without having special accommodations being made. And stage 4 is remission. So that's what we're looking for. And I use the term remission because this is a chronic condition that needs managing long-term. And this, again, is important from a disability point of view. One of the definitions of disability under the 2010 Equalities Act is that we recognise that something is chronic, and it certainly is for most people with EHS. So these 4 stages are useful to medical doctors in trying to understand where somebody's at, and we want to try and catch them at stage 1. That's really important. So, and the next slide just shows how I do a visual analog scoring system to do that, but it's less important. So I'm just going to come out of this now and get back. Okay. So I'll move on with my slides. And in terms of diagnosing for doctors, the main way that this is diagnosed is what we call here in England a clinical history. I'm guessing you guys might use the same term. There's no specific one blood test or scan that can diagnose EHS. It's based on history and exam. And actually, many of our diagnoses in the medical field are created in this way. There's lots of things we don't have a singular test to prove. But of course, we do search for that. And in searching for that, we have come up with some blood markers and some types of scans which can be quite helpful for people, for clinicians trying to investigate this. But the first and foremost is the history and exam, and a doctor familiar with EHS should be able to recognize it from the history. Now, something that gets talked about a lot is the psychological aspects of this. People often suggest that EHS might be a psychological condition. It might be all in your mind. And the reason that people suggest this is because there have been some studies done called provocation studies, which they are when you put somebody in a double blinded situation. So let's say you put them in an EMF insulated booth, and you subject them to electromagnetic fields that they say trigger their symptoms. So that could be low frequency or high frequency fields, but you don't tell them when those fields are on or off. And then you say to them, do you have your symptoms? Now, this type of what we call provocation study has been done quite a few times now. And many of those studies failed to show a response. They did not show that the subject was able to have that response at the correct time that the exposure was taking place. Now, the reason that happened is because those studies were generally a very, very poor methodology. They were designed by people who clearly didn't understand EHS. It's not what we call a time-locked phenomenon. So it's not like switching on a light, where the minute the light comes on, there's a specific time period where that is registered in your brain and you have a conscious reaction to it. EHS is not like that. It's a little bit more like, say, hay fever, where somebody, if they're exposed to the allergen, will develop symptoms in a variable time period. And some days they'll have a good day, and other days they'll have a really profound reaction. So it's more of a grayscale, and it can't be measured in certain ways that they've tried to measure it. However, some of these provocation studies have shown this reaction extremely well. And I'll direct you that if you look up, there's a journal or an article titled Electromagnetic Hypersensitivity Evidence for a Novel Neurological Syndrome. I can send a link to this afterwards. But this was published in the International Journal of Neuroscience in 2011. Authored by Andrew Marino, and first author is David McCarty. This showed that one subject was able to have a somatic reaction, a physical reaction to these fields under double-blinded conditions. And that was a unique study in terms of how it was put together, but there's not much funding for this kind of research. So not very many of these studies have been done, but the fact that it's been proven in a couple of studies shows that it can exist, this physical reaction. And it's my opinion that the vast majority of people who are complaining of this reaction don't have any psychological illness at all. It's a physical reaction that I could go into a lot of detail about the different scientific ways in which we can prove that. This particular study is just one way to prove it. But I'll read you the conclusion of this study. EMF hypersensitivity can occur as a bona fide environmentally inducible neurological syndrome because the reactions were statistically significant beyond the realms of chance. Now, to corroborate that kind of scientific study, we have some new research which is still evolving, but I mentioned biomarkers before. Professor Belpomme and colleagues in Paris have been looking at blood biomarkers and showing that in certain subgroups of people with EHS, they sometimes have raised oxidative stress markers. This wasn't entirely a surprise to many of us in this field because we have already shown through many, many studies now, well over 100, that these type of electromagnetic exposures can create something called oxidative stress, which causes damage in the body if it's left to get out of control. So in some of these people, the fact they have elevated oxidative stress levels in their blood is in keeping with the other scientific literature and shows this physical process that is going on. Now, there are some other diagnostics. There are things like Encephalo scans, pulse Doppler Encephalo scans, which have showed alteration of blood flow, autonomic nervous system disruption, certain types of functional MRI showing change in connectivity. And another test called the lymphocyte sensitivity test, which is a blood test, which looks at calcium influx into cells and has shown that it is potentiated in people with EHS. They have a greater calcium influx when their lymphocytes are exposed to electromagnetic fields. So there's a huge different set of data that corroborates the fact that this is a physical, not a psychological reaction. Now, having said all that, of course, it's very normal that if something is painful or if it gives you negative symptoms, that eventually your brain will start to make you fearful of those exposures. And there can be psychological issues later on down the road that are really quite a normal reaction to having a repeated hostile attack on your physiology. So there can be psychological complications. And of course, this is very disruptive to life. As I've mentioned, some people are forced to leave their place of work and their home, and that can have some very profound psychosocial consequences. Now, moving on to briefly talk about management, I can't go into much detail because we don't have too much time, but I've put together a list of things that I call the A to H's, and I'll send you a slide for this. But this is... Yes.
Would you be able to show that one?
Yeah, I can. I didn't want to slow this all down too much, but absolutely, I will screen share this for you. Hang on. Okay. So it's coming up right now. So this is the A to H's. Can you see that? Okay.
Yes, great.
And so the top one here is avoidance. And I think avoidance is so important. It's the cornerstone, because without actually removing the toxic trigger, you can imagine that, you know, anything else you do is going to have less of a therapeutic effect if you've got a continual toxic exposure that's triggering this negative physiological outcome. So and how do we do that? Well, we reduce the common causes. So electromagnetic radiation from phones, Wi-Fi, security systems, these can be disabled and hardwired in most cases. And addressing the immediate environment, whether it's home or office or school, in the case of a child, can be far more straightforward than people imagine. People are really have become so dependent on Wi-Fi, for example, that they think that you really can't live without it. And that just isn't true. There are lots of, in fact, the most techie people on the planet, that is those who work in Silicon Valley, etc., and the military, for example, they all use fully hardwired systems. So fully hardwired systems are actually state of the art and produce a more reliable, better internet connectivity. So that is how we avoid. And at the same time as we avoid electromagnetic fields, we should also be trying to avoid chemical triggers. So cleaning up the chemical environment at the same time, because we know the two interplay to cause very similar symptoms. Then moving on down through the list here, talking about the rest are talking about optimizing health. So when I put breathe fresh air, I mean, because we can have iron generation from things like air conditioning and heating units that can make air, which is, it can set up very similar symptoms to EHS. It probably is a type of EHS. We see this in the desert winds that carry a very strong iron concentration as well. So breathing natural, moisture rich fresh air is important. I've got here for C, cognition, creativity and care. This is very important, actually, because whilst at its origin, this is not a psychological condition, electromagnetic fields push the fight and flight, or what we call the sympathetic nervous system. So that is balanced by your parasympathetic or rest and digest nervous system. And you need the two to be in a healthy balance. EMF can push your fight and flight, and so can emotional stress. So it is very important to try to help your body by being in a very good emotional state as well. And life can be really challenging for this group, but stress levels can certainly, a bit like hypertension, high blood pressure, stress can actually increase physical symptoms. Then moving on to D for dentition, this is really about metal in the mouth. So mercury amalgams or any kind of metal work around or in the head and mouth area can attract radiation. It's a conductor from mobile phones. It can reflect that. It can intensify fields. And on top of that, you can obviously get leaching of those toxins, release of those heavy metals into the central nervous system, which can cause, again, toxicity and damaging symptoms. So this is just about cleaning up dentition to try and avoid metalwork and toxicity in general. Exercise is always important. And what's nice in people with EHS is to try and combine this with grounding, so bare feet outside, and good hydration and sunlight, because you can often bring all those things together in this way. When I mentioned grounding there, electrical systems need grounding, and we are an electrical system. We can all pick up a lot of charge from our daily lives on computers. And if you're wearing insulated rubber type soled shoes, which most are these days, you might be really carrying a lot of static charge. So it's good to ground that through your bare feet, or in swimming and in bathtubs and things can also help get rid of that static charge. Friendly foods, which was F. I mean here, ideally, an organic rotational diet and full of antioxidants, nice, colourful fresh fruits and vegetables. Hydration, I often recommend glass bottled spring water because of the plastics that can leach from plastic bottled water, and because there's quite a lot of toxins now in tap waters as well. And lots of people with chemical sensitivity find that they're reacting to tap water too. Sunlight and sleep is right at the end here, and this is really just it's very important. If it didn't begin with S, I'd put this right near the top, because sunlight is obviously an electromagnetic field itself, and people are very sensitive to it when they have EHS. They need that healthy full spectrum daylight to make good vitamin D and regulate their sleep-wake cycle, regulate their melatonin production. And a good, healthy circadian rhythm is very, very important for healing EHS. So if you are not sleeping, it's very important to restore that cycle. And how to do that is a lecture all in itself, really. So I won't go into that in detail now. But that was a kind of whistle-stop tour of my very basic management plan. And I'm going to stop sharing at this point. So that I can potentially show a new slide for you in just a moment. Did that work? Have I come back on screen? I don't hear them, but I'm gonna move on. So,
sorry, you are back in the screen. Yes,
great. And I've got a slide here which I'll just briefly point out. Is I talked about avoidance and using flight mode and hardwiring and disabling things, and that's all great. But for people with really severe EHS, you might need to take it to the next stage. And we need to think about the low frequency fields. People often forget about these. These are your household wiring and your overhead power lines. Now, there's some clever things that people with EHS can do, which is about turning your circuit breakers off. So any circuit breakers that you don't need, switch them off, particularly overnight. And I recommend people down power their entire house at night. I actually recommend this for everyone, not just people with EHS. This is actually low frequency fields have also been found to be a group 2B carcinogen. They might be causing cancer, and they are certainly a cause of EHS symptoms. So you want to think about disabling that as much as you can. Some people can't tolerate even having power onto a fridge freezer, so you can consider gas-powered fridge freezers. And non-EMF methods of heating and cooking, like gravity-fed oil systems or solid fuel. And you can, if you want to keep your electricity on, you can consider ELF filtering. So filters to filter out the dirty electricity, or harmonics to keep a cleaner supply. And of course, you can consider really, really extreme for the most severe patients. They often end up primitively camping. They are literally out in nature with nothing but a tent. And whilst that sounds very extreme, and it certainly is, that can restore health for that group incredibly fast, faster than anything else. The problem is it can lead to obviously its own other problems in terms of health with extremes of temperature, and again, breaking that important social network. So but the group that are forced into that are one of the groups I'm extremely worried about. There is a growing number of people who can no longer live in normal urban areas and are forced to very primitive lifestyles, which can endanger them for other reasons. Now, what's very important here is trend. So we want to see that somebody is getting better, even if it's slowly, because trend's very important. If they've changed their life, then you need to see positive improvement. If they're not, if they're getting slowly worse, they will stay on that trajectory and they could get a lot worse. So it's important that with a management plan that we see that people are definitely getting better over time. They'll have good days and bad days. So I don't mean within the space of a week, but I mean over a period of weeks and months, we would like to see positive improvement. Otherwise, something else needs to change. And you either need to go back through those A2Hs or see an environmental specialist to think about more invasive therapies. And importantly, through all of that, be thinking, are you missing a different diagnosis? Is there a different cause for those symptoms which hasn't been treated correctly? I've got another slide here, which I'll just mention, which is about some of the more invasive or more unusual therapies being offered in environmental clinics. So if you do get referred on to an environmental clinic, they might prescribe nutritional supplements, which you need to be very careful of to make sure that the patient isn't sensitive to those. Hyperbaric oxygen is being recommended in some clinics, immunotherapy, antigen therapy, immunoglobulin therapy. There's chelation, therapeutic sauna, pharmacology. There's a really long list, but I'm not specifically advocating any of those. I've just talked about the basic plan. It's just to let you know really that those are out there and being advocated by some clinics. The truth is, in my opinion, I think we need a bit more work and more research to be sure which of these therapies is giving a greater therapeutic effect than just avoidance alone. We need to be testing these therapies on more large scale trials, which I really hope will come at some point. Now, I mentioned immunotherapy, and I just thought I should point out that there is a paper published looking at the effect of low dose immunotherapy on calcium ion influx. I pointed out that we see increased calcium ion influx in response to electromagnetic fields in some studies. And immunotherapy was shown in one study by a British group here from Jean Monroe's clinic at Breakspeare to reduce that calcium influx in people with MCS. It's a bit more uncertain whether that's having an effect on the EHS component. So I would tend to say it might be more useful for people that are primarily focused on MCS. But if it is helpful in that group, it could decrease body sensitivity in general to help EHS as well. Prognosis is something people often want to understand better. And I would say it depends on the stage of EHS and the total duration of illness. I've already touched on the fact that the early stage is much easier to reverse. But I can say, I'm happy to be able to say this, that even people with very severe EHS, I have seen become get to the point where they're feeling completely healthy, as long as they're in a low EMF, low chemical environment and free of molds. Molds is something I haven't talked about in this, but it's also very important. There's a lot of different toxic things. I said people with EHS tend to be multiply environmentally sensitive. But if we clean up all of these things, people can go from being very severely unwell to really in a very robust, comfortable state of health. Unfortunately, if they're in stage 2 and 3, the longer they've been unwell, it's more likely they won't be able to return to the kind of potentially high EMF lifestyle that they may have previously had. So moving forward, what do we need to address this issue better? And one of the things we certainly need is better medical training. So my group, FHIR, we give individual telephone support for doctors to help guide them if they want advice on how to manage EHS for their patients. We lecture to groups of doctors. We've had some large-scale international conferences. We are putting together an educational course for EMF health for doctors now. And we've been doing, certain of our members do things like expert witness reports for court, et cetera, which is becoming increasingly important because a doctor can't necessarily prescribe what the patient needs in EHS. This is often frustrating for us. We want to be able to give you a therapy that we know will work. But if that therapy is a low EMF environment, that's not necessarily something that we can immediately give to a patient, except sometimes through way of our testimony in court to explain that this is real, it's happening, and they need to be supported and accommodated in a low EMF environment. I'm just sharing my screen again for you because I think this might be a useful slide for you to see. So this is something called the NIR 2020 NIR consensus statement. I put this together last year for groups exactly like yours, actually, as a quick information source. So if you would like to, you'll find this on our website. That's phiremedical.org. And one of the tabs will say 2020 NIR consensus statement. Now, this is still open for signing. Any member of the population can sign it if you would like to. And we are particularly supportive of doctors signing and getting on board. And you'll see at the top here all these logos of different international environmental doctors groups who have signed this statement. And in it, what we're asking for is we're pointing out that there is a public health crisis. This is probably affecting much higher numbers than are presently estimated. And that current international governmental advice is often biased by conflicts of interest, or it's simply not up to date. But there's a knowledge gap here which needs to be filled in. And we've pointed out some urgent actions that we want to see happening, including a moratorium on new emitting technology and more stringent safety limits to be truly biologically protected of health. Designation of low EMR zones so that people either who just don't consent to exposures or are actively unwell have safe places to retreat to. Withdrawal of RF fields from schools and in areas where there are vulnerable groups such as children. And a zero tolerance approach to industrial influences on public health policy. This is obvious. It's a no-brainer. Any member of the population would say, I think, with confidence that they don't want their public health policy to be directed by industry-related finance. This is very obvious, but unfortunately, it just really hasn't happened in this way. We saw this problem in the tobacco industry. We saw it in pharmaceuticals, and it's no surprise that we're seeing it again here with what is the largest industry, I think, globally that humanity's ever witnessed. So I'm going to summarize now and tell you that EHS has been proven as a physical response to EMF exposures, even of very low intensities, which is not surprising because we have a huge literature base now, a huge evidence base showing that these kinds of exposures cause adverse biological effects in the general population and in animal studies and in vitro studies, which means it's not surprising that some people are having conscious reactions to it. The management of that should rely on primarily avoidance of electromagnetic fields, but it's sensible to clean up the environment of this group in other ways because they're multiply sensitive. And optimizing general health in terms of the sort of B2H's approach that I mentioned is really sensible. But we need urgent protection for sensitive groups and for those who simply understand the science and don't want to be exposed. So I will stop the screen sharing again. And my last slide here was showing fire, but I'll leave it up to you.
Erica, it was working now, the moving. So if you want to continue.
Oh, was it?
It was, yeah.
Right at the end. No, you know, don't worry. But that last slide just explained the mission statements that we have with FIRE. It explained some of our objectives. And you can find that on our website anyway, on the About Us section. So I hope we've got time for some question and answers. I'm sorry, this was exactly half an hour in when I drafted it. But of course, with the slide transitions, it's probably taken quite a lot longer. So if you have time,
it was great. It was a great presentation. So what I would like to understand is like the calcium influx, do they come out from the bones into the bloodstream and they are increased by the EMF, the non-ionizing radiation for the people that have hypersensitivity?
So it's not specifically that they move from bone to another area, but calcium is an ion which is abundant in the body. It's used for a huge number of important physiological processes, and it's mobilized all the time. So yes, there's a high concentration in bone, but it's also in blood, and it's moving around the body with its physiological functions. Now, this is quite theoretical at this point, but some of the theoretical studies looking at the way EMF affects cells have deduced that, and this is work, if people want to understand this better, there's a lot of work here by a few authors that I'll tell you about. There's Professor Martin Paul, there's Dimitris J. Panagopoulos, who was actually the first person to look at the effects on electromagnetic fields on some of the ion channels. Some of his work was the earliest, and Pilla, P-I-L-L-A. These are all some useful authors to describe this theory. Basically, there is some evidence that channels in the cell membrane, which we call voltage-gated channels, that transport ions, and calcium is just one of them, but it's one that's been quite robustly explained in the literature. These fields can open, or what we call gate, those channels when they wouldn't normally be. And this can allow ions, including calcium ions, to influx inside the cell in higher concentrations than they would normally. And that can have quite an effect on physiological function, including fueling a particular cycle called the nitric oxide cycle, the product of which is something called free radicals. These are damaging ions, which are electron scavengers. They like to take electrons from other molecules, and that can cause an aging and degenerative process. Oxidative stress is normal on a daily level, and there's a balance. We call it the redox balance, where a degree of it is good and it's healthy. But if you have too much free radical damage and not enough ability to absorb those free radicals and neutralize them, that's when you get you swing into a disease-like state. And there are a lot of different endpoint diseases that are associated with this increased oxidative stress. EHS is just one of a long list. I hope that was helpful, didn't it?
That was very helpful, and I will for sure translate that for people to understand it better, that there is a physiological aspect to it for sure. It's not, this is serious, right?
Can I make a question related to the calcium influx that I'm curious about? Because the calcium influx has to do with the cellular membrane, if I'm not mistaken, the potential mm-hmm. of the cellular membrane, right? So it probably affects the oxygen that comes in and out of the cells and the production of ATP. Is it related to the calcium influx or not?
It could well be. We're starting to get into quite complex biology at this point, cell biology. But yes, I mean, loosely speaking, there are lots of different mechanisms that are probably interplaying. And the ion channel theory is one of those pathways that's been described in the literature, but there is also some evidence of oxidative stress happening independently of that mechanism and mitochondrial damage. So I think you mentioned mitochondria there, or ATP you mentioned. Yes, there are some really excellent papers looking at the effect of electromagnetic fields on mitochondria. And the more you read, the more different biological pathways you can see could and are likely to be affected. And oxidative stress in itself can affect multiple different cells in multiple systems. So when we look at the symptoms of EHS, for example, and we see that they're so broad ranging, they affect lots of systems, it's really no surprise if one of the mechanisms of damage is oxidative stress, which we know affects so many different cell groups. But other types of endpoints that have been associated in the literature include things like neurobehavioral disorders in children, possibly neurodegenerative disorders in adults, like Alzheimer's, dementia, that kind of thing. Fertility. Male fertility, there's been a lot of study done on this now. This is a very strong area of the literature, and it appears that we're seeing effects that, again, could be mediated by oxidative stress, certainly that are causing structural and functional damage to sperm. And another area which is talked about a lot, I haven't mentioned it in my talk, but of course, cancer. Oxidative stress is a known mechanism that can increase cancer risk. We can see DNA damage being done from EMF exposures. There's a very good study that you might want to look up called the Reflex Study. It was at one point quite controversial. The results of that study have been really well validated through court as well as through the normal scientific channels. And that showed in a COMET assay, it graphically, you can see the DNA damage from even very small, relatively small doses of RF exposure that were causing DNA damages that looked like ionizing radiation levels of damage. So, this is really just more corroboration for the evidence that we've had for quite some years now, showing that heavier users of mobile phones who've used them for 10 years plus have a higher risk of certain types of brain tumours. And one of those is, for example, glioblastoma multiforme, the GBM tumour. This RF was designated as a group 2B carcinogen based on that evidence. And we now have a lot more evidence for that link in the form of animal studies, which have shown very similar tumour types in animal groups, schwannomas and gliomas included.
Okay, thank you. I asked about the oxygen because of the radio wave sickness. I don't know. I don't know if it's on the EMF conference or not, but it seems to be related to the oxygen in the cells. And as you spoke, the mitochondria, right? At least for me, I think it explained my fatigue.
So looking at the effects on mitochondria could absolutely explain some of the subsequent effects we're seeing. Some physicians are heavily linking EHS with chronic fatigue syndrome with CSF, and they feel it's part of the same spectrum. Martin Paul's work brings five or six different conditions, including CSF, together because he thinks they're all related to the nitric oxide cycle. And in addition to that, there is some other work looking at the effects of EMFs on red blood cells. And again, you know, in truth, this needs a lot more studying. We need more research to be done here. But there's some studies have shown something called rouleau formation, which is when red blood cells stack up like coins in a coin roll. That's why it's called rouleau. And when they stack up and stick together like this, they should be floating around and mutually repellent. So they should bounce off each other. When they stick together, that's associated with a pathological state. That's associated with a number of diseases. And it can certainly impair the oxygen carrying ability of those red blood cells. So again, in terms of body oxygenation, there may be more than one pathway to that being compromised also.
Thank you.
Hello. So thank you so much. I would like to ask the last question because we're almost in the end of the live. So in relation to the gut bacteria and the interactions with the, you know, electric magnetic fields, especially from ionizing radiation, when non-ionizing radiation, when children hold, you know, the cell phones or the tablets near their stomach. And what would be the consequences to that?
So there's increasing concern about the effects of electromagnetic fields on what we call the human biome. You're quite right to point this out, because in terms of total numbers of cells, we're not just us, we're not just our own cells and DNA, we're comprised of a biome that is essential to good health. And this includes flora in the gut, which aid digestion and healthy functioning of the gut, as well as other areas of the body. And certainly EMFs can alter that balance. And there's a really excellent presentation that was part of the 2021 EMF conference from Dr. Sharon Goldberg, which I would really advise people to watch if they're interested in this area as well, where she is explaining the evidence base behind some of the changes to the biome. And also in that, explaining some of the effects on bacteria and potentially bacterial antibiotic resistance. So this is a relatively new area being studied, but I think will become of increasing importance, certainly. And the fact that we have clinically noticed that EHS tends to come in combination with multiple chemical sensitivity and food intolerance is really interesting. This could be related to changes in gut flora, as well as some other mechanisms. But certainly one of the symptoms that people commonly have is gastrointestinal disturbance. And of course, you're right to point out where children hold these devices. So a lot of the literature about cancer, for example, is from phones, where the very high intensity exposure is very near to the brain. And as a result of this, there have been multiple governments give advice, including our government here in the UK. They have given advice that children should not be holding smartphones to their head, except for essential calls. That's how they put it. I would say never except for emergencies. But the problem with that advice is that as a result, what children do with both tablets and phones is they use them down near their pelvic organs. They hold them very close to their unshielded pelvic organs. And we know that certain tissues can be very high absorbers. Microwaves aren't absorbed the same in all tissues. They are absorbed preferentially by some more than others, a bit like food in a microwave. You'll find some bits come out really hot, especially when they have a high water content. So moving the source of highest intensity exposure from the head to the abdomen and pelvis is not smart. It's smart to get it away from the head, certainly, but it's not smart to then move it to the pelvis, where you then have high radiation of the bowel, yes, which may change the biome, but also, you know, if this is causing brain tumors in the head, could it be causing abdominal tumors? The studies that I mentioned, and I'll just say the actual names of those. So the National Toxicology Program study, the MTP, and the Ramazzini Institute study, both found multiple organ cancers in the animals exposed. They had a kind of whole body irradiation, and they didn't just find neurological tumors. They didn't find tumors only in the brain. They actually found some of the tumor types that we've seen in the brain in the heart. It was quite an unusual picture. And this has got to increase our suspicion and concern that actually, when we move that site of high intensity exposure somewhere else, we could be increasing the risk of tumors in other sites, which could be equally fatal. So, and of course, the other thing that's down there as well as your gastric organs and is your reproductive organs. And as I've mentioned earlier, we've got very strong evidence now that the reproductive system is highly sensitive to these kinds of exposures. So along with warnings telling children, do not put phones to your heads, we should also be warning that they shouldn't be using these exposures close to their body, any part of their body. And this is why my group advocates no radio frequency devices at all. We recommend hardwired connections. And even then, you know, you do get some radio frequency just from the components of the computer. And you, of course, get the low frequency fields from the electrical supply. And actually, screen time in general and computer use in general for children should absolutely be limited. We are very aware that education, the best way that children assimilate information is through a human face, is through their teacher. That's how they were designed to retain information, not through a screen. And while screens may have their role in very specific areas of education, they're not the best way generally to educate children. And so my group has a very purist policy that we do not advocate Wi-Fi in schools at all, nor mobile phone active signals. We advocate limited periods of hardwired internet only. I hope that answers your question.
Well, that's amazing. And I'd like to thank you very much, Dr. Erica. I'm gonna leave here your website again, because that's very important for everybody to start to know what these devices those devices can harm our health, and they are not under any standard of security as we thought they would be, and even their tests are not very elaborate, as other people were showing us and in other channels as well. And hopefully that's going to be our next talk here, how the cell phones are tested and their, you know, security or not so secure system. So, you know, I have no words to say, and this is absolutely amazing to have you here and all of your information and your dedication to this, these studies. And it's really great. I thank you very much. And because you were one of the lectures I found for free online on YouTube, just to understand my symptoms of EHS and, you know, to be able to, you know, recover myself and have like a fairly normal life, although the, you know, Wi-Fi is everywhere now. Mm-hmm. So I'm so grateful. Thank you very much.
You're so welcome. Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you, Dr. Erica. It was great, your presentation. Thank you so much.
You're so welcome. Thank you.
Então, pessoal do Brasil, nós vamos agora terminar a nossa live com a doutora Erica Mallory Blythe. E aqui está o site dela, firemedical.org. Muito importante esse site. Vamos lá fazer nossas pesquisas e encontrar muito mais informações sobre os danos biológicos causados pelo Wi-Fi, pelos aparelhos sem fios. Um beijo a todo mundo. Até a próxima.